I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. The presidential campaign has dominated the news this year with the surprising popularity of Donald Trump, who's making the Republican Party elders very nervous. Bernie Sanders, a Democratic socialist, is giving Hillary Clinton a run for her money in her quest for the White House and surprising many pundits. This year, Europe is dealing with the largest refugee crisis since World War II. And Paris was the site for both a terrorist attack this fall that led to the largest death toll since World War II and a climate change conference attended by most of the world's nations. Pope Francis visited the U.S. earlier in the fall and spent the weekend here in Philadelphia. And back in June, the U.S. Supreme Court made same-sex marriage constitutional in all 50 states. Today on Radio Times, we want to look back on those events and many more in the year 2015. And we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Trudy Rubin writes the Worldview column for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Trudy, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
Also with us is Dick Pullman, national interest blogger at Newsworks, also writer in residence at the University of Pennsylvania. And Dick, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You know, I know more and more people who are taking a vacation from the news. And these are kind of newsy people that want to know stuff. And they feel, Trudy, completely overwhelmed, as if someone has taken a giant fire hose of domestic and international news and just aimed it right at their face.
Well, I think that is totally understandable. I'm taking a vacation from the news, sort of, and going to Cuba for 10 days. Not quite a vacation from the news, but it's my vacation.
I hear you.
But I think that it's not only that it's relentless, it's also that it's depressing. And I think underlying that is the sense, which I think is correct, that things are changing structurally in ways that we don't fully understand. I mean, everyone talks carelessly about Sykes-Picot when it comes to the Middle East, meaning that the arrangement that the great powers made at the time of the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, shaping the boundaries of the Middle East, is coming apart. And that's true, but nobody has any idea how it's going to be put together again. There is the sense that new autocratic, non-democratic powers arising, like Vladimir Putin, whose oil prices are going down but still manages now to intervene everywhere, or rising China. And then in this country, you have such uncertainty with candidates like Donald Trump playing on fear and having a love fest with Putin, which makes people say, is our own democracy at risk? So are some people. There is a sense of unease about where the world is headed and whether the era that we have all grown up in, the post-World War II era, is coming to an end.
How do you see it, Dick?
Well, yeah, relentless, depressing, confusing as much as anything. If I'm thinking to pick up on the domestic politics front, you know, we're on the cusp of another presidential campaign, and this one, at least right now in freeze frame, looks so different from so many of the others because of what's happened with the rise of Donald Trump. I mean, nobody's actually voted yet, but 35% in the polls of Republican electorate supports him, and that has been unmovable no matter what he says and does. So there seems to be somewhat of a different dynamic going on here. There's never been quite a candidate like him. I mean, I saw a friend of mine joke the other night that it's like having like this like a Batman villain put into the middle of the race. But you know, here's someone who has never spent a day in public service at all, and so he's completely scrambling the picture. The Republican establishment, if you want to call it that, doesn't know exactly. They still don't know how to take him on. Yes, he's got what seems like a ceiling of 35%. People say, okay, well, he can't go any farther. But a 35% ceiling, is actually quite solid if you've got everybody else divvying up the pie
right
in smaller pieces.
Right.
I mean, you look what's going on. New Hampshire's going to tell the tale looking forward. February 9th, they vote. And what's happening in New Hampshire right now is you have Chris Christie's attacking Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush is attacking Christie because they're all trying to sort of play for the non-Trump segment, but they're all kind of like at this point divvying it up. And so you can go pretty far with 35%.
But what do you think the appeal of Donald Trump is? There's a long list of people that he has insulted, generically speaking, women, Muslims, Mexicans. He's insulted Senator McCain, for his years as a prisoner of war. What is the appeal of that, do you think?
The polling cross tabs, as they are, tell us plenty about who his supporters are, and they are disproportionately white, downscale Republican voters, many of them conservative culturally, but also a sort of somewhat dislocated economically. They're worried about their wage stagnation. They're worried about their economic standing in a changing world, they're open at this point, and they're fearful. They're fearful that the country that they know or that they perceive that America has been is changing in ways that they can't recognize. It's fertile territory for someone to come in, like Trump, and talk in very sort of, simple terms about, to sort of speak to their fear. And the other aspect is they're fed up with politics as usual. I mean, everybody is to some extent.
I was going to say, and who isn't at this
point?
Yeah,
everybody is to some extent. But they, I think, are more so. They feel that more so. And so here's somebody who comes in and he's not talking the conventional lexicon of a politician. He doesn't talk like a politician. So to them, it's also entertainment as well. But he breaks that mold that they don't like.
What's so interesting, Trudy, about him, and we won't spend the whole hour on Donald Trump, I promise you, but going back even just a couple of years, he sounded much more like a Democrat than he does now. I mean, in terms of being liberal on a whole host of liberal issues and ideas.
I think Donald Trump is an opportunist. I think he's a cynical opportunist. It seems pretty clear from the way his spoken views have changed that his interest is in winning. He makes that clear. He will say pretty much anything in order to win. I think that what is so disturbing, among the many things that are disturbing about the way he operates and the tone he has set for the election season, which other Republican candidates are following, is that there are no limits. It's as if the internet has become the norm. I mean, I have noticed, over the last decade, people think they can say anything on the internet because it doesn't matter. So from the time I began doing what I'm doing until now, the level of ugliness on the internet, the personal attacks, the vituperation, anti-Semitism, racism, anything goes. And now that has been brought into the election arena. And it's sickening, but it has become a norm, as if anything goes. Talk shows have become the norm for what candidates will say. Beyond that, the way he plays up fears on terrorism and the way the candidates are playing up fears, as threatening as ISIS is globally, and I have been one who thinks it is a serious threat, it is not an existential threat to the United States. That doesn't mean it cannot deeply harm our allies. It doesn't mean that eventually, if left untouched, it couldn't mount a large-scale attack here, perhaps. But we are not immediately at risk, and yet the way Trump and his wannabes, like Senator Cruz, are playing up this threat. You would think it was coming to your backyard tomorrow. And the saddest thing is to see how vulnerable Americans are to fear, because I didn't think we used to be that. If you contrast the way the French reacted to the theater attack just recently and to Charlie Hebdo attack,
which was earlier this year,
when nine journalists were shot dead at a newspaper and others outside, it was with strength. People came together. And this country, instead of coming together, is being pulled apart by this election campaign led by Trumpism. And that's what I find disturbing, in addition to his praise of Vladimir Putin, which is more than a joke. It means that Trump is willing to praise values which in times past would have been considered un-American, and yet he is posing himself as an American hero. And that tells me how confused the country is at home.
And there are a whole bunch of foreign policy issues I want to pick up on. But let me go to you, Dick, and this is sort of a basic question here, which is how concerned do you think the Republican Party elders are, or the sort of mainstream of the Republican Party? How disturbed are they about Donald Trump, worrying either that he stays within the party and perhaps becomes their candidate, or breaks off and becomes a third-party candidate, making it impossible for them to win in November?
Mm-hmm. Well, they're highly disturbed, and you know, what he's doing is basically he's laying waste to their entire bounce back blueprint that they had written after the 2012 election. They came up, the Republican National Committee came up in, it was released in early 2013, sort of an autopsy on Romney's loss to Obama. And the way they sort of set out the future was they said, you know, we have to have outreach to groups that haven't been voting for us. We have to get beyond our base of supporters. We have to reach out to people of color, gay Americans, et cetera, et cetera. And they laid it out extremely explicitly. They said, you know, if we don't talk to Hispanics or the rising, burgeoning electorate in America, and, you know, they're pivotal in four or five states, and they basically said, and I'm kind of paraphrasing, that if we don't start talking outreach to them, they're not going to listen to a single thing we say. So here they have a front runner who's basically doing the exact opposite of what the party elders and the party leadership and the party establishment thinks is the way to sort of build the party going down the road. So they're kind of stuck with him. They're in a bad place with him, and they're in a bad place without him, because if they're not nice to him, as he puts it, on whatever sliding scale of criteria he considers to be nice, you know, and he bolts the party, you know, his most fervent supporters might stay home. Or if he runs third party, you know, if he wants to, because he has the money to get on the ballots, if he can put the organization together, they might go to him and split the party and make it easier for Hillary Clinton, presumably, to win the presidency. So they're in a bad place with him. Let me just mention one quick thing that Trudy mentioned.
Sure.
You know, about, you know, how we're sort of, you know, irrationally fearful of foreign terrorism. I mean, it's a real threat, but irrationally in the sense of it's disproportionate. There are 10,000 gun homicides in America every single year, you know, which works out to more than 30 a day around the country. And you know, if you actually look at the statistics that a number of think tanks have put together, you know, sort of domestic white terrorists, you know, who can easily obtain weapons. And we've seen so many examples lately, you know, everything from the Oregon school to Planned Parenthood in Colorado. You know, that's the kind of stuff that is much more likely, you know, God forbid, to impact someone than this incoherent, if that's the right pronunciation, fear that all the Republican, most of the Republican candidates in these debates have been going after. And so they feel, they feel they have to Trump in the rhetoric.
Well, let's take a very short break. You both put a lot on the table to discuss.
That's sorry why about
you're, that. No, it's all good. It's all good. Talking about the year in news, both here in the United States and around the world. And our guests are Trudy Rubin, columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. You can read her worldview column in the paper. Also with us, Dick Pullman, and he's national interest blogger at WHYY's Newsworks, also writer in residence at the University of Pennsylvania. We do call this show the Dick and Trudy Show. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499, looking back on 2015. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with the Philadelphia Inquirer's Trudy Rubin and Newsworks blogger Dick Pullman. We are looking back on the year 2015, and you can join the conversation, what the important news stories were in your world. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Trudy, let me go back to you, and let's talk about Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, the two top candidates on the Democratic side. It seemed that Hillary thought, and perhaps her handlers thought, this would be kind of a easy walk to the White House. How much of a run for her money do you think Bernie Sanders is giving her?
Well, he's certainly getting the crowds and the enthusiasm of young people, and so it will be a test of her organizational ability as to whether she can turn out the people who would have voted for him, because I'm sure she's going to get the nomination. I don't know what her organizational capacity is. It's interesting to me in the foreign policy realm. Bernie Sanders is not a foreign policy candidate. He has a domestic economic message. So, and he wants to sound strong while making absolutely clear he is against any adventures abroad and
right.
Full stop and get back to the economy.
Right.
Hillary Clinton, I think, is trying to find her way because she has to distinguish herself from Obama, and she wants to sound tougher. But at the same time, she can't repudiate Obama because that would put her in an awkward position.
She worked for him.
Yes, she worked for him, and she was his Secretary of State. In actual fact, when she was Secretary of State, she did a lot of traveling, but she really did not have enormous input into foreign policy because Obama has always made foreign policy with a very small group of people in the White House, for better or worse, often for worse. So I think it's difficult for her to find her way. I mean, for example, she is calling for a no-fly zone in Syria, and I think that's an idea whose time has come and gone since the Russians came in. And it's clear that neither Obama nor NATO wants to have dogfights in the air with Moscow and is willing to play the game of chicken. And anyway, if you try to put a no-fly zone in place, to what end? Because refugees couldn't go there. It wouldn't be safe. So what are you doing it for? To protect group? Anyway, that's a long story. But I think she is still, you know, trying to work her way around.
Within the, I guess, the confines of the Democratic Party. Dick, do you think that Bernie Sanders has moved Hillary Clinton to the left? That just his his candidacy, what he says, certainly about the economy, as Trudy mentioned, is making her more of a liberal than perhaps her her natural inclinations?
I think that's his probably his chief function in this race. I mean, I thought that, I think that after Paris happened, I said to someone, I thought, you know what, I think this is virtually the end of Bernie's candidacy. Because I thought, you know, once the this is long before San Bernardino, but I thought that, you know, that's not like Trudy just said, that's not his focus. He was on Meet the Press yesterday, and he was immediately asked a foreign policy question, a national security question, and you know, he gave sort of a rote answer, and then immediately, you know, he immediately turned it to. But let me tell you what people are really fearful of. They're fearful of losing their economic standing, and, you know, which is fine. I mean, that's where he's been his whole career. And I think in terms of the domestic side, he is. He's been nudging her. You know, she's been having to sort of probably sharpen whatever distinctions that she can draw between, say, the fact that she gets a lot of you know, Wall Street donations and the fact that the Democratic base is to her left on a lot of stuff, but I think she's covered. You know, I think she's sort of overlapping enough that that I don't see her being hurt in the race for the nomination.
I've asked this question of other people before, and I don't even know what the answer is, but. He's not even a Democrat. I mean, he's running as a Democratic candidate, but he's a Democratic socialist.
He
ran on the – he's not a member of the Socialist Workers Party.
No, it's
which
not
is
like
different.
That kind of – right.
I just struggle with why the Democrats even signed on to this because he's really not a Democrat.
Right. Well, you know, if you – you can – anybody can register to run. You know, I guess. You can sign up to run. You can get enough petitions in some states to get on the ballot. And so, you know, they're certainly going to indulge him. And he votes – he caucuses with the Democrats in the Senate. So, you know, that's enough. I guess that's enough. But, you know, these fights that he's had lately with the Democratic National Committee, you know, are a sign that, you know, he considers them the establishment and him, you know, on the outside of it. And the thing actually about being a socialist he actually gave a very interesting speech 3 or 4 weeks ago that was completely overtaken by events, and it was very undercovered about, you know, what is his brand of socialism? And, you know, what is being a democratic socialist? And I actually read through the speech recently, and it's really actually – it's kind of like FDR, New Deal Democrat. It's really no different. But a lot of people get hung up on the word socialism, which is actually kind of funny because a lot of people who get hung up on the word are also collecting Social Security and Medicare.
Exactly. And I know you want to add something,
Trudy. Yeah, no. I mean, the thing – Bernie Sanders has a message, which is inequality, and actually that's an issue, and it's the same issue.
Very big issue, really.
Right, and it's a real issue. The word socialist is really inapplicable here because, you know, he's not for nationalizing the coal mines. The coal mines are going under anyway. You know, it's an issue that everybody understands is front and center, but the two parties approach from different angles. Donald Trump approaches it from playing on the fear and saying the reason that you white middle-aged men with a high school education or less no longer have jobs, really it's because technology and the factories have closed, but Donald Trump will say it's because of the other and try to stir up fear of immigrants or African-Americans or Hispanics so that that person will feel, they took it from me. Bernie Sanders is saying the system has to address it. In many ways, Bill Clinton raised that issue, too. It's just the language was different and the party label under which they identified themselves were different. He's adding issues to the debate. He's not going to get the nomination. But I think foreign policy will figure more in this campaign and maybe even overshadowing the very real economic issues that he is raising.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have Ann from Drexel Hill joining us on Radio Times. Ann, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much. I'm really interested in the power of fear that you just mentioned. In the Bible, it says perfect love casts out fear. But I think in politics, perfect fear casts out love. Huh. And it's really the harnessing of that fear and the way that particularly the Republican Party has used fear as a weapon and as an incentive and all that sort of thing. Just want to get a little bit more insight on why that plays so well in the American psyche and how that somehow overshadows what we used to say we believed in. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you very much. No, you're welcome, Ann. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Trudy, I'll start with you, and then Dick will hear from you as well.
Well, when one raises the word fear as an issue, you know, everyone of a certain age can't help thinking of, and certainly I wasn't old enough to hear them, but we know about FDR's fireside chats. And I think the comparison with then and now tells us a lot about how you can play on fears at this point in history in the United States. When FDR gave his fireside chats, I mean, people couldn't even see him, but everybody turned on the radio because that is how they got their news. And they heard him firsthand. The country was less sophisticated in terms of information dissemination, but there was a unity. Of course, the unity was also caused by war. Right. But there was huge economic fear in the country, and he was able to speak to the people, and the people listened because you listened to the president in those days, and there was one source of news, radio, and everyone carried him. Now, think how different it is. The country is terribly divided politically. President Obama is not a fireside chatter. I mean, as many have written, including myself, this is not one of his skills. He can give a church preacher's sermon to the mass, but he is not good at communicating and calming fears. And even if he had the FDR capacity to calm fears, which I think would be extremely helpful, it would still be far more difficult because the sources of news are so diffuse now and so fragmented. Nobody listens to the Saturday radio speech the president gives anymore. People tune in to their own cable stations. They listen to news stations that cement the views they already have. And there is nothing drawing the public together. I think it would take a tremendously strong personality. I think Hillary Clinton is better in her speeches at reaching out, but the country is so fragmented that those who will listen to a candidate of one side don't listen to the other. So if a Trump or a Cruz stir up fears, they have plenty of venues to do so, and they stir their base. The test of the United States, I think, in the coming months, election season, and years is going to be whether there is anyone who can bring the country together, because I think fear is stoked when their sense of community is shattered and when people don't feel something in commonality with large segments of their fellow Americans.
What do you think, Dick?
Well, you know, there's human nature. There's a split between the gut and the intellect. And, you know, over time, and so we've seen it really in the last 20, 30 years, you know, the Republicans just have had their track record. They have a better instinct for the gut, for going for the gut as opposed to appealing to the intellect. And I'm, you know, I can't help, I don't know why this just flashed in my mind, but I think of the now half-forgotten 1988 presidential campaign when the Bush senior campaign put out these ads about Willie Horton, a black convicted rapist in Massachusetts, and sort of, you know, made it look like Governor Mike Dukakis, the Democratic candidate, had, you know, let him out, and that that sort of fear of black rapists in the suburbia was kind of like their message. You know, and so when it came around to the debate, one of the debates, and they asked Mike Dukakis, you know, would you ever, you know, what if your wife was raped and killed? What would you do?
I remember that, yes.
You know, and everyone was kind of waiting for him to say, I would, you know, well, my first instinct that I would want to wring the guy's neck with my bare hands. And he gave this very discursive, distancing, intellectual response about the death penalty. And everybody said, well, that's it for his candidacy. And it was, you know, frankly, it was kind of similar to probably the way Obama would answer it today. And so, you know, so
fear works,
and you know, and fear works. Fear can drive people to the polls. And this whole notion of social media and the fragmentation today and the customization of one's own news and information sources. You know, I get emails all the time, you know, about the Obama is a Muslim, and we are afraid of Obama because he's a Muslim thing. And sometimes every once in a while, I'll get the energy up to write back, and I'll say, well, where'd you get that from? And they'll say, well, you know, I keep getting these emails. I get out there. Everybody's saying it. And, well, who's everybody? Well, it's some viral thing going around that has no basis in anything. So you combine that with someone like Donald Trump, who, frankly, is the first presidential candidate who has, like, mastered Twitter. You know, and he gets on there and he, like, you know, cranks out this stuff in 140 characters, unfiltered, you know, by the media or any other arbitrator. You know, that gives us the sort of the I hate to use the word cesspool, but this the debasement of political language today.
Well, and Donald Trump was a birther a couple of years ago. He was supposedly sending people to Hawaii to get to the bottom of Barack Obama's birth certificate. He was asked about that maybe 6 months ago or something, and he said, "Oh, that's just yesterday's news," and kind of poo-pooed it.
Not right, because he's into whatever the next news cycle will present. It's like sort of like the way Joe McCarthy was in the 1950s. Hey, Joe, what do you got for us today? Oh, well, okay, here's a document with 10 more communists in the State Department.
Let me shift gears here, and I'm looking at you, Trudy, and I do want to talk about the refugee crisis in Europe. As I understand it, this is the way it was in World War II in terms of the dislocation of population. I think we're talking about 1 million people. Some of these incredibly heartbreaking stories of families just determined to make it to Europe where they feel they can be safer than they are in, what, Syria, Iraq, other parts of the Middle East. And some concern about whether this could tear Europe apart or affect the EU, you know, the attempts of Europe to sort of be one body in a lot of ways. How do you see what's going on there? And how do you see this ending?
Well, you know, those are two different questions. Let me just say something about Syrian refugees first. You know, about half of this huge flow coming in to Europe is from Syria. And Syria is a refugee crisis unlike any other we have ever seen. Most of the Syrian refugees who are coming have education. Syria was a highly literate society. A lot of them are middle class. Many of them had small businesses or farms. These are not your dirt poor refugees from Africa or Afghanistan. And in fact, I'm told by experts in Germany that many of these single Afghan men who are coming recently because people are trying to send their sons out because Afghanistan is going south and are being sent back even though it's a conflict zone. And most of the African immigrants being sent back because they're considered economic migrants. So Germany will be under a huge test because they have taken the most, hundreds of thousands. The Syrians, on the one hand, are better able to assimilate. They want to learn the new language, but this is a huge number to swallow. And one thing I would point out, since we're coming to the new year, I've been told by people in Berlin that one of the biggest fears is how are you going to educate them? But second, about money coming in from Saudi Arabia, possibly, to fund mosques and imams. Germany, until now, has most of their imams who come from outside, come from Turkey. There's an agreement. And Turkey sort of keeps a lid on radical imams. There's a real fear of Saudi Arabia. So flag this for the future, because Saudi Arabia, our supposed ally, sends money all over the world to train Wahhabi imams, hardline Islam. The only thing that separates that from Al-Qaeda or ISIS is that they don't support overthrowing Middle East regimes. It's just that they promote a version of Islam that is hardline and anti everyone else who doesn't adopt it, including Muslims. That's just the flag. But the bottom line is, with such huge numbers, how will they be absorbed? I think there's a better chance with Syrians, but it will be extremely difficult. Just a word on the future. Donald Trump's buddy, Vladimir Putin, they've been exchanging public love messages about how wonderful that each thinks the other is, has a policy. And the policy is to drive as many Sunni Syrians out as possible, because those are the opponents to President Bashar al-Assad of Syria, whom Russia wants to keep in power. So another thing I would flag for the future, this peace, supposed peace process that is going on now, including Russia and Iran, don't take it too seriously. There will be more bombing of civilians by Russia and Assad to push more and more refugees into Europe and tell them, unless you accept Assad, here's what you get, more Syrians.
That's Trudy Rubin. She writes the Worldview column for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Also with us, Dick Pullman. He writes the National Interest blog for WHYY's Newsworks. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Trudy Rubin and Dick Pullman about the year in news 2015, looking back over important events, news events here in the United States and around the world. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, the news story that really caught your eye. Dick, I was thinking, as Trudy was talking about the refugee crisis in Europe, also in this country, and this country has a reputation for accepting people, although it's pretty clear that we are trying to limit the numbers of refugees coming from Syria, I guess, via Europe and other places. And some states have even turned back or refused to admit Syrian refugees because they don't want them within their state. Mm-hmm. Is this a challenge, you think, for U.S. politics and policy?
Well, you know, part of the problem is that when some candidates rail about the Syrian refugees, is that, you know, there's, how to say this as charitably as I can, there's a lot of Americans who really, you know, they don't follow foreign policy, don't follow what goes on in other countries. They really can't, a lot of people can't really distinguish the difference between Syria, Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, you know, it's all one big, you know, they don't know the difference between, they don't know that Syrians are, you know, an educated, middle-class, literate people as opposed to any others. And so, you know, that, again, playing on fear, that's one of the reasons why, for example, the House in mid-November rushed through this bill to try to toughen up the vetting of Syrian refugees and perhaps make it harder for some more of them to come. But I was just looking at this piece that just ran a couple of weeks ago, which says now it's getting a little more complicated because now there's a lot of lawmakers who are actually trying to slow down this thing that they passed and maybe amend it, because it just happens to be that, you know, the biggest national security threat is not necessarily from Syrian refugees. It's about foreigners who perhaps arrive on student visas and other by other means. And so, you know, this is often a case where politicians in the rush of events or panic, you know, will fire off in the wrong direction. And then maybe later on they'll come to their senses and, like, look a little bit more sensibly. So it's a challenge in that sense to try to sort of see things rationally and not get taken up by the fear.
Well, we talked about ISIS earlier, and I mean, there is, I guess, a little good news, Trudy, in that looks like Iraqi forces took back Ramadi, at least as of this morning or as of yesterday. So I don't know. I don't want to make too much of it, but nonetheless, a little bit of success on the ISIS battlefield.
Yes. Well, I have argued in repeated columns that the best way to confront ISIS was to start via Iraq, which I think is what the administration wanted to do. I mean, Iraq, you at least have some basis to build on. And after all, the largest city that ISIS holds is the city of Mosul in the north, which once had 2 million people, and which is their economic capital, so to speak, of their so-called caliphate, even though Raqqa in Syria is supposedly their home base. The tricky wicket in Iraq is you have a weak prime minister who is constantly being squeezed and threatened by Iranian-backed Shiite parties, including even his own party, and Iranian-backed Shiite militias, which are trying to take over from the army. I mean, what Iran would like to see happen is what happened inside Iran, where you had Shiite militias that basically took over the army from within, and the army itself was marginalized, and then the Shiite militias became the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Force, which is their main military. Yeah. So Abadi, the prime minister of Iraq, has been under threat. And there's a lot of pressure from these Iranian militias for them to go into Sunni areas. He managed to hold that off for Ramadi. This is an achievement, but it's far from over. There's still pockets of resistance. The key, however, is that supposedly after Ramadi is taken back, when it is, not really yet, Sunni tribes from the area, their fighters will be sent in to police it. The key in Iraq is bringing Sunnis into the game. There are Sunni tribes in the north of Iraq who want to go into Mosul and take it back. It has to be Sunnis. The Iraqi army is far, far from ready to take back Mosul in the north, which is critical. And unless those Sunni tribes are brought in, it won't happen. But so far, the Iranian-backed forces in Baghdad have prevented arms from going to these Sunni tribes. So I think that will be the critical thing, whether the take-back from Ramadi gives the prime minister, who's a good guy, more power to help Sunni tribes take help in the take-back of Mosul.
You know, Dick, I'm thinking about the numbers of debates, both the Republican and Democratic debates, where this issue of ISIS came up and certainly foreign policy coming up again. And what you hear from a number of the Republicans, not all of them, interestingly, is a pretty muscular approach to foreign policy. Ted Cruz talked about carpet bombing ISIS. Chris Christie talked about sending in ground troops. I think it was Rand Paul said, you know, if you want World War III, he's your guy. He was pointing at Chris Christie. So it's interesting to see, and it's a little unclear exactly what we hear from the Democrats, but in terms of a choice there, I guess you've got a more kind of in-your-face foreign policy.
Well, yeah, you know, it's in-your-face mostly in terms of tone, I think, tone and style. I did a piece a few weeks ago where I was basically arguing that if you really listen to what the Republican candidates have been proposing, and Hillary too for that matter, it's that I haven't seen anything that's really appreciably substantively different from what the Obama administration has been doing, particularly since Paris. Christie and I think John Kasich a little bit have sort of talked a little bit maybe about ground troops, U.S. ground troops, but nobody else is doing that. And for all of, you know, Cruz's tough talk, where he says, Trump says, I'm not going to repeat Trump's obscenity. Of course, this is how the language is changing. But he said we're going to bomb the whatever out of ISIS, and Cruz says we're going to carpet bomb ISIS. Well, you know, we're bombing the heck out of them right now. And the whole thing about carpet bombing, you know, which is a term that I thought went out with the Vietnam War, which, as I recall, didn't particularly work out that well, is that, you know, how do you carpet bomb ISIS when they're embedded in cities among, you know, women and children? And so, you know, he said, we're going to make the sand glow, where he seems to think, at least in terms of his rhetoric, that they're camped out in tents out in the desert away from everybody else. It's just not realistic. So,
you know, is that nuclear war if you're making the sand glow?
Well, you know, it does have that kind of – it has that kind of resonance, but it's aimed at people who are just like really ticked off and frustrated and have no other real way to vent. And so it's the kind of language that appeals, I think, to people who are sort of – have that mood. But in terms of substance, I don't know, maybe Trudy disagreed with me, but I don't really see much different from what the administration's
the
doing.
The phrase used to be bomb them back to the Stone Age.
That's right.
Oh, was that Curtis LeMay from the 1960s?
Yeah, as you may recall.
It shows how old the three of us are. Go ahead, Trudy.
Yeah. You know, I think there is a difference. There has been a difference in the past, actually, between Hillary and Obama. At this point, though, I don't really think the Republicans have a strategy that would work better. I don't know that Obama knows anymore what he's doing. But what fascinates me is that when Cruz talks about carpet bombing or Trump uses obscenities about bombing, in a sense, they are linking up with Putin, whom both of them seem to admire, because Cruz also has said that he thinks we should ally with friendly dictators, basically. Authoritarian regimes are fine with them. Democracy building is over. That was George W. Bush.
That's right.
And Mario Cuomo is still along that track, as is Hillary Clinton. So there is a split here between those who say Assad should still go and those who say, no, a friendly dictator is better. But when you say bomb them until the sands glow, what it reminds me of is that Vladimir Putin, what he did in Chechnya. In 1995, I watched from a hilltop overlooking Grozny, the capital of Chechnya, as Russian heavy artillery fired nonstop into 10-story civilian apartment buildings in Grozny below, because they had made clear they were going to level the city until the Chechen independence fighters were dead. And many of them were in basements, so they just leveled the city. And in those apartment buildings were many Russian retirees, old grandmothers. Putin doesn't care about killing civilians. So in a sense, what Cruz is saying and what Trump is saying is, slaughter the civilians, bomb Raqqa back to the Stone Age, doesn't matter to us, get rid of ISIS. The United States and Europe, we have taken a different position, maybe gone too far in the other direction about collateral damage. But I can't quite believe this country is ready to do the equivalent of what Assad is doing now. Assad is barrel bombing civilians, and the Russians are now bombing civilians in areas held by Syrian rebels, bombing hospitals, bombing markets, bombing schools, if that's where we want to go. You know, in World War II, we did it in Dresden.
That's right.
But now images come out on cell phones. We see civilian slaughter. It's considered a war crime. So I think that's one difference. Slaughter civilians seems to be the Republican logo. And we have to decide if that's the way we want to go or if there is another way to go.
Dick, let me put something else on the table. And we've got some comments here that I do want to – you just exhaled there.
Yeah.
You're feeling depressed.
Well, you know, I mean, I was just thinking of, you know, Trump's praise of Putin. I was kind of thinking, I thought the Republican Party at one time was the party of, you know, sort of, you know, human rights. And, you know, we would, you know, this idea that we would embrace somebody who crushes political opposition and has major political opponents die mysteriously. The idea of sort of praising that kind of regime, it just seems it runs counter to certain kinds of small d democratic values.
and walking around with your shirt off, showing off, to set, you know how.
Yeah, I think Trump wants to ride on a horse, bare chested. I think that's his aim.
Let me ask you, Dick, though, about President Obama's year. We're looking back at the year 2015. What kind of a year do you think he has had? And from my observation, it feels like he's forging his own legacy and trying to do a number of workarounds when it comes to the U.S. Congress.
There was a lot of things that happened in 2015 that, you know, for a second term lame duck president would be considered, you know, quite impressive, and maybe in the long lens of history they will be. I mean, I guess most notably the one that jumps to mind first, not necessarily the most important, is that Obamacare continued to, you know, embed itself in the fabric. Apparently, sign-ups now, we're in a new sign-up period right now, and apparently they were running ahead of projections. And there's a story in the New York Times this morning about how a lot of Republican governors around the country are accepting Medicaid expansion under Obamacare because they want to help their citizens, and they're sort of at loggerheads with Republicans in Washington and Congress, you know, who still have an ideological opposition to it. And so, you know, so I think things like that could still be, I think, his signature domestic achievement. But a lot of the workarounds, like you said, is through executive action. And, you know, and he still has that going for him in 2016. And I think we'll probably see some more of that.
Very quickly, Trudy, I want to get Rochelle on.
Yes, I think that his foreign policy legacy is going to be decided in the future, because I think the two biggest things that will be referred to are the Iran deal, which I think did stop Iran from getting right to having the material for a bomb in the short term. But we'll see what happens in the long term and how well they stick by it. And it's being undermined here by the Congress as well. And then the climate change. But the climate change is also a hope for the future. Yeah. There's no enforcement provisions. India's going to double their coal usage by 2020. So again, name and shame, we don't know if it's going to work. ISIS, it's a big question mark. I think he goofed 2 years ago, and now it's hard to develop a policy. And he will be judged on that. And recognizing Cuba is nice, but it's not a major foreign policy issue.
Let me see what Rochelle from, it's like Hatboro has to say. Rochelle, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah. I just wanted to comment that even though this might sound drastic, I see a lot of similarities between Trump's rhetoric about making America great again and demonizing segments of the population. Very similar to what Hitler did in the 30s, where he, you know, convinced the German people that he was going to make Germany great again, and he started demonizing segments of the population. And ironically, too, initially, Hitler and Stalin were very chummy in the beginning, which kind of, I see another similarity between Trump and Putin.
You know,
anyway,
Rochelle,
just a comment, and
absolutely,
if either of your guests would care to comment I'll take it on the air.
They're chomping at the bit. We have a minute. Go ahead, Trudy.
All right. Just remember, 35% of likely Republican voters in the primary is only a small percentage of those who will vote in the final election. We do not know. I don't think we are facing Hitler yet, but I think Trump is shameful.
Go ahead.
Well, as a matter of fact, just to the caller, I wrote a column this morning. It's posted on Newsworks on this very subject. And I was quoting from a historian talking about when Hitler was a presidential candidate. And he said, this is a quote, there were no qualifications in what he said. Everything was absolute, uncompromising, irrevocable, undeviating, unalterable, final. He seemed to express the voters' deepest fears and desires. And he goes on like that. Now, I don't want to say, you know, I'm not saying suggesting that Trump is Hitler or that America's on the eve of 16 is like Germany. But I think we have to guard against any flirtation with autocracy.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Dick Pohlman's National Interest blog is at Newsworks. You can read the article that he just wrote this morning. And Trudy Rubin writes the Worldview column for the Philadelphia Inquirer. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our newsletter and listen to us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us, though. We'll be right back.